2 hours of us. Stay with us.
Raises the question, who owns the land? The homeless are a problem for only one reason. Our president raises the question, who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead Indians? Who owns the land? Could it be 6 million Jews? Who owns the land? Is there a connection? Who owns the land? To all imperialism? Who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me? Who owns the land? I am just a white man. Who owns the land? I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to sleep. This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to be. Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be that there's a connection? Who owns the land? To my daily eviction. Who owns the land? And the extermination. Who owns the land? Of the Native American. Who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me? Who owns the land? I am just a white man who owns the land. I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? Owns its own self. Maybe it's the Native America. The homeless are a problem for only one reason. My president raises a question, who owns the land? The homeless are a problem for only one reason. Your presence raises a question, who owns the land? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home?
And welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And actually, we're going straight into a caller. Hi, caller. Can you hear me? Caller, are you there? Hang on a second. Now can you hear me, caller?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Now you can be heard as well.
Okay.
Hey, I guess we ran into each other at the courthouse today, and you had some things you thought needed some public airing, and I let you know there was a show tonight between 6 and 8 dealing with civil rights for poor people. And I'm also, of course, concerned with corruption in the courts and corruption in the sheriffs and police department. Hey, I'll let you take it from there. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I do not know that it's corruption. I don't know what it is, but it's very curious. A person that that hired me and rented me some space, it was a small, it was a issue about codes, etc.
Uh-huh.
Very simple issue that could have been taken care of, mm-hmm. and it was not taken care of, and I ended up having to take this person to small claims. And that turned into a can of worms of being cross-complained and being sued, and it just has gone on from March 13th until the present. Presently, I am now being taken to court for small claims court, mind you, for extortion, perjury, and items that we have already been to court over, which, as you, I'm sure, are aware, is illegal. And it's just very interesting. In the meantime, I've done a background on this person, and it turns out that he was convicted of a felony, and he was sentenced to 4 years. 3 years were probation, and 1 year was, according to the DA, Mr. Bob Lee, who I think is a genuine person from what I can gather. It's just the information that he has says that the year was served. However, I have a public document that clearly states it was not served. And so there's a bit of friction here. And I also had questions as to why the same person that was convicted of the felony was, again, in a public, another public document, found and recorded to say, I am going to get my gun if this doesn't stop, to a police officer, in front of the police officer while complaining about a tenant he had a problem with. And as we all know, felons aren't allowed to have guns. I'm also concerned that this very same person, after his conviction, was arrested, not convicted, arrested for rape, and it was dropped by the DA. Not Bob Lee, he's a new DA. I don't know who that DA was. He was. So we're looking at rape, arrest, dropped by the DA. We're looking at battery, dropped by the DA. And we're looking at contempt, which was also dropped by the DA.
Now, is this a powerful person in the community, this individual we're talking about?
Not to my knowledge. As far as I know, it is a person that has a Mr. Rogers, if you will, laid-back personality, and really does not display.
Is he economically, or is he or she economically powerful?
I believe so. According to Reference USA, which is a pay site, but the public library pays for it, and anybody listening to the radio, for example, or anybody in Santa Cruz, can use that can use USA Reference to find information. In this case, this person, the person himself reported to, I don't know whom the person reported to, but it was them that reported themselves as making $1.2 to over $2 million a year. They do own a quarter of a block in Santa Cruz, and that is rental property and their own company that they continue to own and operate.
Well, I know that large companies can have a real impact on even local mini institutions, like the Metro of Santa Cruz recently let go of columnist Bruce Bratton. I don't know if you read. Do you read the Metro, caller?
I do read the Metro, and as a matter of fact, I'm in touch with someone from the Metro that is very interested in this story.
Huh, interesting. Well, apparently, you know, Bruce Bratton, who I don't always agree with, I thought he was too vanilla and milk toast for my taste,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the issues I was concerned about. But he was, you know, occasionally come out on some issues, I think, rather strongly, like the failure of the city council to set up a plaza downtown because of its concern about large landowners and crossing conservative merchants, or possibly the Seaside Company's power in town. And apparently the Seaside Company is what did him in, according to what he told me today. I ran into him just before I spoke to you for the second time outside the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
He was essentially fired from the Metro without any explanation whatsoever immediately after he wrote a story critical of the Seaside Company.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, the Seaside Company came in, Representative John Robinson, who previously was a Sentinel hack, went to the Seaside Company and became a PR agent for them. And then this fall, in the matter when Proposition Q was making the rounds, a Seaside company funded a proposal to essentially give a lifetime sinecure to, what is it? It's not the Chamber of Commerce. It's the Tourist Bureau of the city. Mm. So they didn't have to go to this. They get $300,000 every year anyway from the city council, but they wanted to institutionalize it. Mm. He went to the when he heard that Sarah Phelan was going to be doing a critical article of the Seaside Company, they went to the Metro and they threatened the Metro with withdrawal of all advertising. So, mm-hmm. You know, the powerful people can have an impact in this community.
Yeah.
I doubt that the person you're talking about is as powerful as the Seaside Company is in this town, but,
if
you have a powerful property owner or landlord, they can presumably have some kind of impact as well.
This is pretty much his own little empire or domain, if you will, and he doesn't necessarily go outside, but he does rent to a number of people. And when you and I met, I was checking out I'd say 20 cases of people that didn't get their deposit back,
This is a landlord we're talking
back.
About.
Now, if you take 200 to 900...
This is a landlord, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
In this specific instance.
Okay.
He's taking me to court for extortion and perjury, and it's not a cross complaint, it is, but I don't know if he received service. He doesn't have to open the envelope, in other words.
So you're a dangerous character. You're an extortionist and a perjurer, and what else are you?
Yeah, that's right. And I would take somebody that was a perjurer and extortionist to small claims, too, wouldn't you?
Small claims.
Small
that's kind
claims.
Of a strange place to take an... I guess he couldn't get the DA to file charges against you, huh? Because extortion and perjury is not so much a basis for a civil lawsuit, it's a basis for a criminal prosecution, I would think.
Exactly my point.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. How does this relate? I'm sorry to kind of, be hustling you along, and I am here, and I apologize for that.
No
we
problem.
Got two people in the studio and another guest probably coming in on the phone shortly.
Okay.
What do poor people, what does this say to poor people? What do you have to say, how this impacts poor people? Give us some connections here.
Well, I think the best advice, if I may, is to go down to the county records. It's public information. Find out who the person is you're possibly renting from or doing business for or with or renting, whatever the case may be that you're getting involved with, and check it out. All you have to do is type their name into the computer and what do you know? You will find so much information that you'll be very surprised. Or you will verify that this person, in fact, is legitimate and you can take your next step. In other words, just take the preparations necessary before stepping into a hole. That's the most reasonable, practical thing I can say.
So again, before you rent from a landlord...
Or do business with anyone.
Or do business with someone, because I think you also told me this individual owns a business that he fired you from as well.
That's
right?
Correct. I found myself in a position of losing all my money, of being fired and being evicted because I also rented a room from this person temporarily. I was on the street with nothing. And to this day, 2 months later, I've only got $60 in my bank account. Now, I'm used to making $64,000 to $100,000 a year. I'm a skilled tradesperson, and it's quite a jump. It's quite a jump down.
I hear you. What's your next step?
My next step is to get this person off my back and leave.
So you're...
You know, the economic crisis in the nation, let alone Santa Cruz, is great, and I need to live. I need to survive. And that basically is my only option at this point.
How long have you been a resident and worker in Santa Cruz?
This trip, it's been a few months, but I've been from the Los Gatos area up on Summit Road since 1973.
And what is your trade?
I'm a glazer. I'm a certified journeyman glass worker,
uh-huh.
And I also work with stained glass and things affiliated with that, and that would include sandblasting, etching, slumping, blowing, etc.
How can an individual? I'm coming into landlords' possible, you know, jurisdiction. I want to decide whether to rent from him. What do I just take his name down to what to do what again?
Well, the first thing you should do on the first floor, I believe it's, I'm sorry, I don't know what room it is, but it's easy to find. Where the records are, there's a desk there. They'll tell you exactly where to go, an information desk. You can go check out their civil records in one area. Just punch their name in the computer, and that'll give you a list of, that'll give you the answer to the history of their civil or their small claims history.
Now, we're talking about the law library?
It's not the law library. It's on the first floor.
First floor, not the basement, in other words.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Of the county building.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And again, what office are we looking at? We're looking at one of the municipal court clerks or the civil?
I believe it's room 102, but I'm not certain about that.
Okay. And
when you walk through the doors, you will come to a window on your right-hand side.
Are there several windows? There's
just one window. It's an information window.
Uh-huh.
And if you say, I'd like to check out somebody's history, they know exactly what you're talking about, and they'll tell you exactly what room. You just walk forward, you turn right, and I believe it's your first door on the left.
Okay.
You can't miss that. And if you want to check their criminal, that's across the hall, directly across the hall from that. And they are two separate things. Make sure that you check both of them.
Right. Actually, I think you're thinking of the criminal windows and the civil window, too.
That's correct.
That's as you walk in from the courthouse to the county building. And the first set of doors you encounter as you go through the opening doors, they aren't sliding, they open out. Caller, I appreciate your calling in. I want to thank you for, you know, kind of giving us, we haven't gotten into the specifics of your case. In a way, I'm glad about that because it doesn't require me to go to the other individual if we were naming him or her so that he or she would have a chance to reply specifically.
Right.
You're using him more as an instance of what people have to be careful of, at least from your perspective, right?
Right. That's mm-hmm. the bottom line. That is what you need to do to protect yourself, and you can save yourself so much trouble, and I strongly recommend it.
Well, listen, thank you, caller, and please stay tuned and call in again if you'd like, if you got more to add or if you know, are there any further developments you think that we should know about?
Thank you very much. I will, and I really appreciate you giving me airtime.
Sure.
And I'll be listening.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. In case you didn't guess, you're tuned to Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. My ghost host in the back is Jeffrey Gale, and in the studio with me, I'm about to introduce my guest, who I know only as Roger, but I bet he has a last name, too. Do you want to give that as want to bless us with that one?
Sure, Bournique, Bournique, and that's French.
Okay, let me get you a little closer there, and a little bit closer to the mic. We have cranky equipment sometimes.
Oh, is that better?
That's better.
Okay,
that's louder.
Very good.
Now, Roger, you're a man who's. Last time I saw you, you had a full head of hair, and now you are as bald as that ancient dead actor Yul Brynner.
Yul Brynner, I like that. Telly Savalas is actually a little bit closer to the mark for me, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you're an egghead, all right. I got to say that.
Yeah.
What caused you to shave all your hair off there?
Well, I've been indulging in some Buddhist head shaving ceremonies as a peaceful protest at various peace marches in the area.
Wow. And when did this latest shaving happen?
May 2nd. Well, George Bush was in Santa Clara at United Defense Industries, so there was a protest there, a rally. And my friend Rob shaved my head during the rally there, during the first speaker.
Now, the rally was in San Jose?
Santa Clara.
In Santa Clara?
Right by the airport.
Did you get a chance to shake Bush's hand and clap him on the back or whatever else you might have done?
Not quite. You know, he came within about a block of us in his motorcade, and there was quite a lively voicing out of
some blood-curdling screams, yeah. Emulating perhaps his fine work in Iraq.
Yeah, you know, I don't think people really liked him very much. They, you know, they were screaming "fuck you, Bush," and you know,
no
go back to Texas. Oh yeah, there were about 75 to 100 yes Bush people there. American flags, and there was a few altercations, but nothing too serious.
How large was your protest?
With about 1,000 people, the paper said, but I thought it was a little bit smaller, between probably 750 and 1,000 maybe. It was hard to an accurate number is difficult to gauge and something like that.
I remember reading about it on the Indy Media website. He was coming in to visit some defense contractor or some such.
Yeah, he came in to crow a little bit about the war and also to try and sell his tax plan to Silicon Valley. And, you know, because traditionally he doesn't have too much support in this area. But everybody seemed to like him inside where he was speaking, I guess.
Now, how long did the protest last?
From about 8:30 in the morning till 1 in the afternoon.
Wow, you guys are patient. And he came by for a brief span of 5 minutes a block away, huh?
Not even that long. They sped out in these black SUVs. You know, they looked very, very sinister.
Ah, well, perhaps it's the latest equipment.
The new Canyon Arrow or one of those SUVs that are so popular these days.
Well, the reason we have you in the studio is not to, commend you for your politically correct, and I also, I approve of what you're doing, too, in terms of opposing Bush, and I think it's important. It's not the fact that Bush is coming to town, but the fact that we have to make a response to this. Indeed, I think a lot of the anti-war movement has been, if not demoralized, perhaps more quiescent after the active invasion of Iraq has now subsided to occupation, punctuated by the shootings of, I guess, two U.S. soldiers were killed today in Iraq. And
I was expecting far more people there, and I thought there'd be thousands, because Bush is coming to town. I thought, man, if this doesn't get people out, nothing will. But there was about 1,000 people there, and the police presence was very, very large. Course.
Well, I noticed he didn't do much West Coast visiting in February and January, so maybe that says something. So, and then before we close on this topic, I still haven't heard back from Mayor Emily Riley as to when she plans to hold a city council meeting with a resolution which has been 4 times postponed, demanding that the U.S. troops end the war by leaving Iraq. I mean, the war hasn't even ended. They haven't even declared an end to the war. I think he said the fighting has concluded. The U.S. is no longer doing trade sanctions against Iraq. The U.S. is appointing people like the head of the medical staff, or the Department of Medicine or Department of Health, whatever it's going on over in Iraq, according to Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Today. And in consequence, hundreds of medical workers and doctors are on the streets protesting and demanding that they want to have the right to vote in those people, to vote in the heads of their departments, and not to have the same old Saddam Hussein hacks set back up. Of course, this shows quite clearly they couldn't give a shit, to use a quite candid phrase, who's running the country and how it's being run, provided that their bastards are in power. But again, I suppose I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Probably something nothing you don't agree with.
Yeah. Well, it's in their best interest to keep an open war going, because then they can maintain a presence there almost indefinitely. And if anything comes up, they can use force.
Right. I don't even think they need to have a war to maintain a presence. I mean, if they get a puppet government or a friendly government, if you want to use that phrase, then all they need to do is get their cooperation and invite American troops to remain or American, American interests. And, of course, you have the situation where the UN has been excluded from the country, at least. I guess they're inviting them in for humanitarian aid, but not for the weapons inspectors. Instead, you have this new team of U.S. inspectors, which is still having a lot of trouble finding anything that looks like what Powell so elaborately claimed were the weapons of mass destruction.
People will quickly forget about it, because the attention span of America seems really short.
Well, I'm glad that people like Amy Goodman are covering this in Democracy Now! Again, I don't do the follow-up to see whether she's, accurate in what she says, and so I'm left with, at the moment, suspending my disbelief, and I'm reporting what she gave us this afternoon on her show. But I don't have to suspend my disbelief with respect to the subject of the show today, or at least part of our subject, which is to do with heroin use. You're a known heroin user circa 1996, right?
Yeah, I started in the late 70s during the punk rock revolution in San Francisco. There was a flood of Persian heroin, and all the punk rockers were doing it up there, smoking in clubs, and I kind of got involved in it then.
Now, were you a good punker as well as a good shooter, so to speak?
Yeah, I spent my time at the Mabuhay and the Deaf Club,
I probably saw you there. I was there in 77 at the Mabuhay.
It was a great place,
yeah.
I mean, the last show I saw there was the Flamin' Groovies, It was pretty cool.
And so you were, how often did you use heroin during the 70s?
Not real often. I just basically chipped, you know, maybe a couple times a week, you know, for a long time. You know, I didn't really become a hardcore addict until the mid-'80s.
And what was responsible for that?
Well, I got in a punk rock band called the Woodpeckers, and everybody in the band was basically on drugs. And
you didn't want to be the sore thumb.
No, well, I, you know, whatever. I was doing a lot of drugs myself, and it just sort of exasperated the thing because, you know, we wanted to really get high and play.
So as an adjunct to your playing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just like it sort of fueled everybody's drug use.
What instrument did you play?
I was a bass player.
And were you making your living as this, or was this a sideline? Or
living? yeah, we'd make basically a little bit of money, you know, from playing some gigs. You know, we played, like, downstairs at the Cooper House a bit, and Lulu Carpenter's, and O.T. Price's. We never did play the Catalyst, though. We played parties and, you know, wherever we could find a place. And
Once you started using heroin regularly, how often did you use it?
As often as I could get my hands on it, you know, probably 2, 3, 4 times a day.
And did it affect your ability to play? What did it, in fact, improve your playing? Or
It affected everything in my life. I lost everything. I lost my desire to be creative. I lost all my equipment. I lost my stereo, my place to live. Everything went into my arm that I could possibly get a hold of. You know, I pawned or, you know, sold for dope.
So what year would you say that, you know, you became intensely involved in heroin? Was there a particular year when this happened? Or?
Yeah, about 85, I think I really started rolling, you know.
And you were in the band since 77?
I wasn't in band since 77. I was, you know, spending a lot of time in San Francisco, you know, in the drug scene up there. But basically, I wasn't a medical hardcore addict until about 85.
And were you still functional as a performer when you were a hardcore addict or not?
Yeah, you know, well, the kind of music we were playing, you know, wasn't very difficult, you know, so you could get up there really loaded. I mean, I played my best shows probably really loaded.
Because it's often been said that even doctors who are, you know, often regular, some doctors are regular heroin addicts, it doesn't necessarily impair their performance.
No, in fact, when you're, you know, finally a medical addict, you're basically just fighting to stay well, to maintain, you know, the kind of awareness where you can tie your shoe in the morning.
So how much money did that require a day in 2003 dollars?
Back then, the price of heroin is a lot higher than it is now, and it took about $100 a day to buy a gram of heroin.
And that's how much you needed to stay well, so to speak?
I'd split that. I'd usually use about a half a gram of, you know, usually Mexican tar heroin every day.
And now the same amount would cost how much?
A gram of heroin goes for between $30 and $40 on the street now.
So the marijuana price goes up, but the heroin price goes down. This sounds like 1970 Operation Intercept under Nixon, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I hear that Afghanistan is having a bumper crop of opium poppy this year.
So is this kind of enticing you to perhaps get back into the heroin scene?
No, I'm sober for the rest of my life now. In fact, I just recently gave up drinking on January 18th and smoking pot on January 18th of this year, finally.
Have you given up chocolate as well?
Not quite. I haven't gone that far.
Well,
you've
got to tell me when that happens, because then I will kick you out of the studio. Right?
It was the whole political climate that just kind of scared me straight, and I wanted to be sober so I could try and be of some use to getting this asshole out of office.
So, So while you were at your peak of heroin use, how long were you able to maintain both as a heroin user with a real apartment and a real job? Did you have a job other than the musician work? I mean, were you other regularly employed? Or
I had a job making tempeh for a while, but I lost it because I was always having to go out and score during the day. And finally they said, you know...
Tempeh is not tempura. What is tempeh?
Tempeh is a soybean product. It's like...
Oh, right. Gotcha.
Yeah,
you know,
it's made with soybeans, and you add a spore to it, which grows and turns it into a unified patty, which you can cut into chunks and stir-fry, and it makes wonderful food.
I know there's some of the Chinese restaurants that have some tasty tempeh.
Yeah, yeah, it's good stuff.
So in 85, you were kind of going hardcore. How long were you able to maintain at that level?
For a few years, you know, I started procuring for people and doing various fiddling things and various kind of slightly criminal things to keep it going.
Did you contact the CIA for a better contact with the... the drugs?
No, there's no shortage of contacts. They're easy to come by. They find you.
This is in San Francisco, right?
I was living in San Francisco and down here. I lived for a while in the Tenderloin, and that was a really beat scene.
And now one of the reasons I asked you to show up on the show, and by the way, we met because you called me and wanted to interview me for a radio station in Oregon, right?
Yeah, Pirate Radio Tequilma.
Coho.
Yeah.
Let's hear it. By the way, we are also heard in Free Radio Olympia in Washington at 91.3 and Mojo Radio in Mendocino at 87.9 and again also in Free Radio Ashland in Oregon at 87.9 FM. All these pirates relay Free Radio Santa Cruz live at various times. And, of course, you can catch us on the Internet at, it used to be www.microradio.net/FRSC and probably still is. You can probably, they'll switch you to the latest website, which is, I think, changed. But it's www.microradio.net/FRSC/, that's it actually, www.microradio.net/FRSC. We're also, of course, at 96.3 FM, and you can call us now live at 427-3772. If you're out of the area, of course, the area code is 831-427-3772. Off air, if you want to leave a message, 427-4523. We're talking with Roger Bornik.
Bornik, yeah, that's right. Don't forget, that's French.
Bornik. Monsieur Bornik. C'est bien. Heroin in français.
What did you say?
How do you say heroin in French?
Oh, God. Probably skag. I don't know.
Who knows? Yeah. In any case, you were conversant with the Santa Cruz scene and the San Francisco heroin scene.
Yeah, both of those places. Yeah, pretty easy to be a heroin addict in both places. I found heroin actually easier to score down here in Santa Cruz.
And even in the mid-80s.
Yes.
What was that scene like? Were you indoors? Were you outdoors? Do you want to give us some sense of...
I was mostly living in a studio apartment with my girlfriend, and, you know, it was a pretty dark scene. What can
was
I tell you?
Was she a junkie as well?
Oh, yeah. We both were using... full time.
How did it affect your relationship with her?
You know, basically your needs come down to one thing. You know, you want to score. You know, everything boils down to just that. It's not like it opens things up for you, it closes things down. And you know, a good day for us was able to, you know, get as much heroin as we could get.
Now did you it's often said that heroin, because heroin is illegal, it's extremely expensive, relatively expensive, and requires people to do a lot of theft or else have a huge trust account or something to have enough money to afford the ongoing habit. Is that true?
Well, it helps to have money if you want to be a heroin addict. I mean, you know, that way you can avoid a lot of hassles with, you know, getting the money together. It's really problematic. You know, we weren't rock stars. We were just like common junkies.
Were you bank robbers? You feel free to confess on the air at this time, if you will.
I mean, I can say the things I've done. You know, mostly small-time crap, you know, shoplifting, a lot of procurement, you know, some smash and grab, a couple other things I really don't want to go into because I don't know if the statute of limitations is...
We'll wait on that.
Maybe another year.
For all our police friends who are listening in, we can kind of avoid that. Jeffrey, you seem to be kind of edging closer to the mic. What do you got?
Well, I just wanted to ask this gentleman, as he probably knows, about 1920, heroin was legal in the United States. All you had to do was go to a doctor. Doctor wrote out a prescription. You went to Walgreens and you filled a prescription. So do you come from a place that the time has come that we need to legalize all drugs in the United States? I mean, the issue lately is dealing with medical marijuana, and I personally believe that what's going on in Switzerland is good, that Robert pointed out on the show last Thursday night that apparently in Switzerland, according to your research, Robert, you can go into a particular room and get a dose of heroin. It's perfectly legal. It's all prescribed by physicians in Switzerland. Do you think that we should push for that here in the United States?
Absolutely. It seems to work in Switzerland. And the crime rate dropped, and addicts were seeking treatment on their own in order to kick their dope habits, because when it's treated as a medical problem, it's a lot more compassionate, I believe. And I really look to the Swiss method as something that could work here, but, you know, with the political climate that we've had in America for the past 200, 300 years or whatever, it's never going to happen here, because they always say, it sends a bad message to the youth of today, you know, or some other such bullshit. And, you know, it's a great way for the government to control people, to keep them disenfranchised, whatever, you know, to keep them powerless.
Did you attempt yourself to find a drug treatment program in the 80s?
Oh, yeah, many times. You know, I went through methadone 21-day detoxes. I checked myself into Janus. I did that. It was basically everyone was unsuccessful.
And why would you say they failed?
Because I would get out and start hanging out with the same people I hung out with before. You really got to change your scene if you're going to try and be serious about staying clean. You really got to not hang out with the same people. But, you know, I knew all the punk rockers and the musicians, and the interesting people were the ones I was attracted to. So they were always having the drugs. And so I would just fall back into it. One time I had just come out of Janus. I was clean for about 3 days. And, you know, I'm like, I'm starting to feel better. And in walks his friend, and he had a gram of Persian heroin, and it was really good. And I was like, get the spoon, get the rig, you know.
I got this gram of Persian heroin. It's really good. You want to, for the first time in radio history, just kidding, folks.
You know, it's funny. You know, I could have, a pound of dope in front of me right now. I don't think I'd be tempted. I don't know why it is anymore, but I just don't have the hunger I used to have for it.
By the way, you know, when you mentioned about him shaving off his hair, I do want to mention, Robert, that Yul Brynner, every single morning for 25 consecutive years as the King and the King and I, went to a barber and had his hair shaved off. He was not bald. He had a great head of hair. He smoked himself to death and died of cancer, but I wanted to put that in as an aside. Also, my late first cousin, Ronald M. Cohen, who was a well-known screenwriter for 35 years, died of a heroin overdose.
Name-dropping alert.
About 5 years ago, and he went to the same clinic in Wickenburg, Arizona, where Daryl Strawberry and the Dodgers they'd send all the Dodger players there. So I want to ask you, they told him at these clinics, where he'd go for 6 weeks, that it was crucial that the minute he got out of the clinic, that on a continual basis, hopefully once a week, he would go to Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and Ronald never did. So eventually the heroin did him in my opinion. I love him to this day. I'm not over it. He's like a brother. He committed suicide. So I want to ask you whether you believe that someone that goes to these clinics, gets dry, needs to go to weekly meetings, or can someone actually get off a serious drug like heroin without ever going to any weekly meetings?
I hated those meetings. I only went to a few, and I made some good connections there for dope. So it's fucked up. You know, you go there, and you're sitting in the back, and you're sick, and all of a sudden you're sitting next to somebody who's sick, and they go, hey, let's go get, you know. And I always hated the 12-step programs, and I probably went to 3 meetings in my entire career. So, yeah, it's possible to kick dope without going to NA or any of those 12-step programs. I did it. It was...
Were you involved with the law at all? I want to hear how you kicked dope, but I also wonder, what was your involvement with... Did you get arrested? Did you ever serve any time?
No, it's some form of miracle in my career. You know, the most I ever got was cautioned by the police. I've had my money taken away by the police. I've had...
Santa Cruz police?
Yes, down there in the Beach Flats.
Well, naturally, they don't want you to buy any heroin. That's probably why they took your money away.
Beach Flats, I'd scored probably hundreds of times down there in the early part of my usage, you know, because I didn't have a regular connection at that time, so I had to go buy from strangers down there.
So the police helpfully took away your money.
Yeah, money, or if they found... The one time, you know, they took away, you know, my points, you know, but they didn't take me in, which was unusual. I told them at that time, I said, look, if you just let me go, you'll never see me down here again. And they said, okay, go. And I'm like, gone.
And the next day you showed up again? No.
I found somebody to buy from, yeah.
Through them.
Yeah, it was pretty sick.
So you avoided the courts. What year did you finally decide it was time to get clean and you were successful?
Well, my wife and I got on the waiting list at Triad for methadone maintenance. And, you know, some time went by and we just didn't really think that we were on the list anymore. And then one day things were bad. Things were bad, and we ended up calling, and they said, it's funny you call today, because your names are at the top of the list just today.
What year was it?
1991.
Okay.
And so...
This was in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I called a friend because we needed $1,500 for both of us to get on the clinic right away.
So wait a minute. So you don't get... This is if you got the money, you get into these clinics.
Yeah, you need the money, or if you're on Medi-Cal, you know, you can get it for free. But we were private pay. And at that time, you could be on maintenance, and it cost $150 a month per patient. So we were paying $300 for both of us to get onto maintenance. And it's, you know, it saved our lives, basically, because we had just about, we were really sick. We didn't know what we were doing. It looked like we would probably be homeless within a matter of weeks.
Had you been homeless before?
At various times, but not for very long. You know, I lived in a van for a while, you know.
Not while you were a heroin addict yourself?
I was while I was chipping, you know.
But not as a person who's had to spend a lot of time, spend all his time seeking heroin.
Yeah, I was never really a serious homeless person ever. You know, for some reason I always managed to find a roof to sleep under, or, you know, a place to crash, you know. I'd done a lot of couch surfing, you know.
So in 91 you went into a program, and that was a methadone maintenance program?
Yeah, methadone maintenance program where, you know, you get on and you basically, for most people, they stay on for the rest of their lives.
And this actually is the subject that kind of really perked my interest when we talked about it before, which is that you're concerned that methadone itself is a kind of a straitjacket, which in some ways, you know, although you can function on methadone perhaps better and you don't have to pay exorbitant amounts of money for it and it's legal and that sort of thing, you don't have to use dirty needles or whatever, but
most people that are on the methadone program use other drugs. Cocaine and crank are really prevalent with methadone patients.
Don't they do drug testing?
Yeah, they do, but, you know, like, you get dirties and that just means you can't get any take-homes. You get caution, you have to get counseling, you know, and then there's always a lot of people will smuggle in clean urine in various ways, mm-hmm. and, you know, get
is that
around.
What you did? Were you using those drugs when you were...
In the first year, I was still using, you know, but I found that no matter how much dope I did, it just wasn't satisfying to me, and I felt fairly satisfied with my dose of methadone, to tell you the truth.
How many times do you have to shoot methadone a day?
Shoot it? No, you...
Oops, sorry. Showing my ignorance. Go ahead.
You go in once a day, and you get a... You know, my dose was 70 milligrams a day, and you get... You know, the nurse has the bottle there, and it goes through a little computer into a cup, and then she pours a little water on top, and she watches you drink it down, and that holds you for an entire 24-hour period. You don't have to... You don't get sick. You don't get abstinence withdrawals. You just... It holds you.
But you get a much more severe withdrawal if you have to go off methadone, right?
Yeah, you know, it seems the withdrawal from heroin lasts from anywhere from a week to 10, 14 days at tops. But methadone, it can go on for like 3 months.
And you actually experienced that, right?
Well, no, but I never did except through detoxing off methadone. You do the 21-day detox, and the first 2 weeks are great. And then the last week that you're on it, you get real brittle. And
meaning?
You just have no energy, and you feel like your bones are brittle somehow, that you'll just crumble and fall to the ground if, you know, somebody touches you wrong.
And this is a detoxing that's different than going cold turkey, right?
Yeah. You know, I've had friends who've gotten busted that were on the methadone program, and they don't dose you in the Santa Cruz County jails. So if you're in jail... You just have to go cold turkey, and it's really a gruesome experience from what I understand.
More so than heroin withdrawal.
Yes, because it's such a resilient chemical, this methadone. It was developed in just before World War II in Germany, and I know, leave it to the Germans to develop some really awesome shit. But
methadrine and methadone. Huh?
Well, actually, the Japanese developed methadrine in 1903.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. For the reason I associate it with the Germans.
Yeah. They tested the methadone on concentration camp victims. You know, they give them large doses for a period of time and then, you know, take it away all of a sudden.
Exciting.
Yeah. The mother of my children is listening to this show in Evanston, Illinois tonight, and every morning at 7 o'clock, she counsels heroin addicts who are on methadone in Evanston, Illinois. And what I wanted to ask you is, you know, do you feel basically that someone needs to go through some kind of a counseling program before they get off the heroin and then get on to methadone or something else? Do you feel counseling plays any positive role in this whole scenario we're talking about here?
Yes, if you have the right counselor. I mean, I went through a whole bunch of them through Triad, and a lot of them were bad and, you know, worthless. and stupid in some of them, but I finally met one counselor who actually was of some use to me. And it's funny because he was the intake nurse at Janus when I did a detox there. Then he ended up at Triad later on, and then I happened to get on maintenance, and he was there and ended up being my counselor. And he was a good man, and he had some good ideas. He helped me start a paper at the methadone clinic called the Scuff Shoe Review. That would we printed articles by and for methadone addicts, and printed poetry and short stories, news in the addiction world. You know, it was a good little paper for a while.
So again, kind of skipping around here, the Narcotics Anonymous, which I think is prescribed by courts if you are, you know, convicted of drug offenses, is to you, as far as you can see, you think it's just, was it useless for you, or is it generally useless?
Big resistance to 12-step programs, you know, right from the start.
It's because of your treasonous atheistic beliefs, in other words.
Oh, well, you know, yeah, I suppose.
Well, we do have a higher power. It's George Bush, and I would try to
fuck
keep that
George in. Bush. I hate him.
Well, now you see, there you are. Your atheistic is coming out again here in the studio. We may have to, you know, do something about that.
Allegedly, you're talking about a recovering cocaine addict, the president of the United States. I wanted to also ask you, my friend Alan Swartzberg has been involved with Cocaine Anonymous for 25 years. He goes all over the country, you know, talking to people that they should join this or whatever. But when Daryl Strawberry last month was released from prison, he went on national television, and he's in his early 40s, and he said that he wanted to be incarcerated because he felt that by, for the first time ever in his life, really being incarcerated, that that was going to be the way that he was never going to use cocaine again. So I'd like to ask you, do you believe that Mr. Strawberry is setting any kind of an example as one of the most famous baseball players of the last 20 years down there in Tampa, Florida, and in New York? Or, where do you come from on that? He intentionally wanted to go to prison to finally, once and for all, never use cocaine again.
Well, I don't know where Daryl Strawberry is coming from, but we all have the power to kick the pushers out of our lives. I'm really, these days, against hard drugs, especially heroin, crank, and cocaine. And we need to be aware these days that there is a evil power sweeping through this country and is headed by George Bush, and we need to be sober to try to get this fucker out of there. And I really want to urge all of you with an earshot, if you're using drugs, get off them and get sober and see what's happening. I don't care about stuff you grow in your yard or you buy beer at the corner store. You know, just fucking get aware, you know.
Well, isn't alcohol in some ways a deadlier drug than heroin?
Yeah, for some people it seems to be.
Yeah, I mean, alcohol, I mean, certainly is a higher mortality rate for people who use it, and not just that, but for people who are, you know, hit by drunk drivers and, you know, suffer industrial accidents because of drunkenness and alcohol abuse. And yet this drug, of course, is not prohibited. And you believe that these drugs should be decriminalized or legalized, right?
Yeah, I do. I think they should be decriminalized because it's a medical problem. I think if people or the powers that be would institute a program where it's decriminalized and get these people out of prison and, you know, into some kind of a medical thing where they can get, you know, the heroin they need or the methadone they need. I don't know. You know, it's up to the person which one they choose.
You're listening, by the way, to Robert Bournik. Jeffrey Gale's also in the studio, as am I. Robert Norris. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz's Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Twice a week, Civil Rights on the Street show, or, you know, we kind of range in different topics, this being kind of a street topic. If anybody wants to call in, whether you're a heroin user or a non-heroin user, we will take your call, 427-3772. If you'd like to call in, you got any questions for our, I don't know what to call them, experts, but certainly a person with some experience in this area. Perhaps he can give you some sense of the different qualities of the grades of heroin. You might be able to...
Oh, yeah, you know, it seems to be going up these days.
Yeah, have you had any connection? Are you anxious about, like, at all when you see, have you seen much heroin use in Santa Cruz recently?
Yeah, I have. Actually, I know people that are they're still involved with the methadone program, and they're still using various drugs besides methadone, heroin, crank, cocaine are really
big.
These
are people you knew from the 80s and 90s? Or
yeah, you know, there's some of them are still around. Some of them are dead.
And these people you, I mean, are you on friendly terms?
I don't hang out with them anymore. I can't, you know. It's just, you know, I try and be compassionate, and, you know, if I see them, you know, just try and help them a little bit as much as I can. But, you know, for myself, you know, I'd still be tempted, you know, if I'd hung out with people who are using drugs. You know, sure, I'm only human.
So has the scene changed in the last 10 or 15 years, and if so, how?
The drugs have gotten more plentiful and cheaper.
And you mean in spite of George Bush's fine anti-drug campaign and the war on drugs run by Presidents Clinton, Bush Sr., Reagan Jr.?
Yeah, you know, the need is there for the drugs. You know, people want them, and they're willing to pay for them, and there's people willing to make them and supply them. And one of the big things that happened was that Colombia started producing heroin. At first, they weren't having much success, and the heroin was kind of shitty, but they quickly got their act together, and now they're putting out a really quality product that's just, like, flooding the market.
But you apparently haven't sampled it yourself recently.
I haven't sampled the Colombian heroin. Most of the stuff I did was, most of it, 90% was the Mexican tar heroin that you see so much.
So maybe that was one of the reasons. You didn't really have the quality stuff, so you decided the scene really had to be eliminated. You didn't want to get into that.
Yeah, I had connections for dilaudids and other forms of morphine. I had, you know, occasionally the Persian heroin that would come through occasionally.
Any other changes? I mean, are there changes in the way people relate to each other? Are there changes in the way the police are treating people who are using heroin? Are there changes in, is the scene different in any way other than the fact that it's cheaper?
I don't know. I always felt that, you know, addicts and people who are used are always treated as subhuman as far as...
Well, you are, aren't you? I mean, aren't you those dirty, druggy types?
Well, I may be a sub-genius, but I'm not subhuman.
I see.
Yeah.
One of the arguments, Roger, that's going on in the legal community is whether, as a culture, we should decriminalize all drugs or legalize all drugs. Would you please give us your opinion and talk about the difference between decriminalizing drugs and legalizing all drugs in the United States?
Well, it's a tough question. I want to point to the Swiss method where, you know, addicts would go into a clinic and they could use at the clinic, and they would get free heroin if you're basically homeless and poor. I don't know if that's legalized or decriminalized. I don't know what the difference is between what they did over there in Switzerland. I'm not really sure about that. As far as, like, completely legalizing drugs, you know, it's a poisonous substance. And, you know, it can really fuck up people's lives, especially speed. I'm really down on speed. I've seen it really destroy some friends of mine recently.
And, of course, a lot of people would say that nicotine is definitely a poisonous drug.
I hate nicotine.
How do you feel about the fact that some people believe that we shouldn't allow anyone to use nicotine in the United States because some people say it's the most addictive drug to really get a handle on?
Plus it's also the most deadly,
yeah,
more so than alcohol.
I'm going to rant here because this really comes down to the whole thing of, you know, consumerism and the government pushing stuff on you, which they say is okay, but it's not really, so they make it a fetish item, like tobacco. It's so fetishized, I can't believe it. They make it so attractive to people, and it's so deadly. I mean, it killed my father. He smoked 3 packs a day and eventually killed him. It was a horrible death for him. I eventually went back to see him in Florida. He was completely jaundiced, lying in bed in a coma, and, you know, dying from smoking 3 packs a day. You know, then some people argue, well, it goes with, you know, freedom of choice. Yeah, you have freedom to smoke tobacco if you want, but it really irks me that, you know, these big tobacco companies put out these huge monumental. They spend billions of dollars to push this product in advertising. And it's a drug.
And they contribute massive amounts of money to congressional campaigns and to things of that sort, and they lie to congressional committees about it, and they don't suffer much in the way of consequences for this. I've often said if I decided to become a violent, bomb-throwing type of person, I would the tobacco executives might be my first target because they seem to be the most lethal. Well, perhaps, you know, the military would be, you know, perhaps up there too. But the military at least has some excuse in terms of, you know, the theoretical possibility of an invasion of the U.S. Theoretical possibility of an invasion of the U.S. Here's a story, safe injection facilities, and I'm kind of jumping ahead here and probably jumping ahead of the country, too. Although it's true that there are, you know, what, safe injection facilities and safe inhalation facilities in, I guess it's Switzerland, Germany, and the Netherlands, or three countries that have done this, is what I've
been
reading.
That's what I've heard, yeah.
You know, and as I pointed out in an article I read by Ethel Nadelman last time, from National Review, mind you, as I said, very conservative publication, rah-rah for George Bush, but obviously taking extreme exception to his position on the drug war. That's one thing that William F. Buckley has always been way ahead of the curve on. This is, I'm going to read a little bit of this, and I want you to comment, and Jeffrey, you can comment on it too if you want. And, of course, you can, too, out there. Our phone is not ringing off the hook, and, you know, it could be. 427-3772 is the phone number here. Safe injection facility. Should Victoria have a safe injection facility, SIF, pilot trial? Introduction. The drug problem is one of the most complex issues. Victoria is a province in Canada, right next to British Columbia. Or is it? Maybe I'm thinking of Australia. It might be Australia.
I think it's Australia, because
yeah,
I've
right.
heard that they've been thinking of doing that there.
Yeah. This is an old story. This is 6 years old.
Ah.
But, you know, still, I think some of the issues raised are relevant. The drug problem is one of the most complex issues facing society today. There is no simple or single answer to this issue. Illicit drug use affects all communities and every level of society. One of the principal reasons for looking closely at the experience of safe injecting facilities overseas, which has pertinence to the Australian context, is in their perceived ability to substantially curtail the incidence of death from overdose in the injecting illicit drug-using community. Across Victoria, there were 125 deaths from heroin in the 12 months to June 30, 1997, and many health workers are concerned that hepatitis C has the potential to be of epidemic proportions. There are no quick-fix solutions, and anyone who thinks they have the answers to these problems is deluding themselves or intentionally engaging in misinformation. It has been continually stated the only way forward in the development of drug policy is for decision-makers to have an open mind when examining possible strategies to address this burgeoning problem. It is unfortunate that many options and possible alternative approaches have been consigned to the too-hard basket because implementation of these measures is seen as politically unpalatable. In terms of the urgency of canvassing and assessing a range of alternative strategies to the escalating drug problem this country is facing, it has been universally acknowledged that past policies and practices have had little efficacy in substantially countering this problem, and in particular, the increasing prevalence of illicit drug use. Revisiting past policies or maintaining the status quo is, in fact, a retrograde step and an admission of failure. Prohibition and the resurrection of the law and order approach to the drug problem has been shown to be ineffective and a waste of police and community resources. Politicians and other decision makers in society, if they are honest about tackling the complex problem of increasing illicit drug use, need to canvass and examine in a bipartisan way a range of alternatives, even where these may be perceived as being radical. The public debate. While there may be many obstacles to the establishment of a trial for a safe injecting facility, the public has shown an increasing preparedness to discuss and explore new programs and strategies to tackle the problems that it's currently facing. The pilot program to set up a safe injecting facility would proceed on the basis of a medical and scientific experiment with stringent evaluation and monitoring procedures based on the collection of detailed data. As has been argued in other discussion papers that have been looked at this issue, if a pilot program is set up, then in order for this to be successful, it is better that this be done in a number of sites rather than being concentrated in one municipality. This would curtail problems with one area being singled out as a perceived magnet for drug users. The actual number of sites would be the subject of further analysis. Actually, and then we go into some of the specific problems around various areas in Victoria, including environmental pollution, prevalence of inappropriately discarded needles. This was, of course, an argument used in Santa Cruz against the needle boxes that were provided in some of the public restrooms.
Right. You know, I would love to see this. I'd love to see safe injection sites, but it seems it'll just never happen in this country. You know, it's just like having a place where the homeless could conjugate, you know, legally and in freedom and fellowship. It just won't happen because, yeah, we want these things, but not in our neighborhood. You know, we don't want these people in our neighborhood, and so it's a hard sell here. And then there's the whole federal thing that they're all down on it. They want to keep the drug war going, you know, because they can play their little CIA games all over the world, you know.
And there's also this right-wing Christian fundamentalist ideology that is sort of, it's not, you know, it's a sort of a Protestant ethic, I guess, behind the idea.
God, don't get me started on that.
So in other words, when, because it's the fifth anniversary of his death tomorrow, when Francis Albert Sinatra, Frank Sinatra, died, one of the most famous movies he ever made in the 50s was called The Man with the Golden Arm. It was about a heroin addict. So that word golden arm, I mean, the bottom line here is we're dealing with a lot of mahula, a lot of money, right? Money.
Fabulous amounts of money, yeah.
Here's some more about the Swiss experiment. And this is given, this is part of the, a good overview of safe injection facilities success overseas, where this means over in Europe. It's given by Kate Dolan from the National Drug and Research Center in a recent edition of Connections, Berlin, Australian magazine. Under the heading, The Swiss Experiment, she stated that injecting rooms sanctioned by the government and funded either by government or non-government organizations have been operating in Switzerland since 1985. Centers now operate in Bern, Basel, and Zurich and are available to people aged 16 and over. And summarizing the main benefits of SIFs, she states they are aimed to reduce deaths from drug overdose, to reduce the spread of infections from the shared use of injecting equipment, and to reduce the public nuisance associated with drug injecting in streets and parks. Other points she makes are, the typical injecting room is discreetly located within a large center which includes a cafe, counseling room, and clinic for primary medical care. The rooms where injecting occurs are small and quite sterile. They contain several tables at which clients sit to prepare and inject their drugs. Injecting paraphernalia such as needles and syringes, a candle, sterile water, and spoons are placed at each position at the tables. Paper towels, cotton pads, band-aids, and rubbish bins are available. Clients generally stay in the injecting rooms for about 15 to 20 minutes to inject with a maximum of 6 to 10 people at any time. Clients prepare only their own drugs in the injecting room. Staff are not permitted to help them inject. One staff member is present in the injecting rooms at all times, rotating hourly. All staff are trained to resuscitate clients if they overdose, with one staff member assigned prime responsibility on each shift. Doctors are employed on a sessional basis and visit the center for a few hours a week. Some centers have direct phone lines to police and ambulance services. Approximately 100 clients visit each center every day. In Zurich, over a 12-month period, there were an estimated 68,000 injections, 3,000 abscesses treated, 22 clients resuscitated, and 10 calls for an ambulance to attend. The main reasons given for attending injecting rooms in 1995 were to inject in peace, to obtain free injecting equipment, and because medical attention was available. In terms of a principal reason for setting up a trial of the safe injecting facility in Australia, which would be to measure the impact on overdose statistics, Dolan states that there have been no deaths in any injecting rooms in Switzerland to date, and that some workers believe that the number of deaths due to overdose in the community has decreased as a result of this. In summary, Dolan states, injecting rooms have been well tolerated in their communities with benefits clearly outweighing costs, and that injecting rooms are now well established in Switzerland, but only seem to be needed in particular circumstances and in certain locations. Any comments?
Well, I think the first one in America should be called the William Burroughs Memorial Safe Injection Site. I think that would be an appropriate name for it.
He was a heroin man.
Oh, yeah. He wrote a great book called Junkie and another one called Queer, which chronicles his heroin use pretty well. They're wonderful books if you ever get a chance to read them, if you want to get a really good firsthand account of clinical addiction. They're fantastic.
Has anyone ever written much about the heroin scene in Santa Cruz from a, you know, either from an artist's perspective or from a user's perspective, or I don't know, someone who's been involved with the people, who's had a human, you know.
Yeah, I have. I've written stories in the Scuff Shoe Review, the paper I had in the Triad.
And you will be putting this in the public library, of course, in downtown Santa Cruz.
I have copies at home.
Because they can put that in the not the research section, but the the reference section.
So, oh, maybe so I should bind them all together and, you know.
Definitely.
And put them in.
Use the Patriot Act. Patriot Act number one and number two with libraries. I mean, I don't know.
You can wear a beard and a wig when you go in.
My Groucho glasses?
Yeah, you can wear your grouchy glasses.
I need
glasses.
A wig because I have a bald head now.
Right. Well, just shaved
it for world peace.
Shaved, not bald. Let's keep that in mind. It's good resources in the Santa Cruz Library. It's one of my favorite buildings. That's why I was so pissed when they kicked out Jan Golder. We heard him on the air the other day.
It's one of the few public buildings I actually trust.
Yeah, well, to some extent, although it took them a year and a half to say we won't be giving information to the feds. I'm a little surprised it took them that long.
I used to work there for 10 years, from 1981 to about, well, not quite 10 years, probably about 8-9 years.
Yeah, the reference section of the library is a good place to go. If you want to look at past homeless civil rights struggles, my paper, the Street Shit Sheet, can be found in all its glory on the on the shelves of the library in the Santa Cruz main branch downtown in the reference section. You can also, of course, read Street Spirit. Street Spirit's the homeless newspaper homeless people sell, all you homeless people out there, or poor people if you're near homelessness. You can call Becky Johnson, who's the main master vendor, 429-8529, if you want to get be a vendor and sell Street Spirit. Probably won't make enough to buy heroin, but you'll make enough to buy a cup of coffee or two, you know.
Yeah.
And it's got a lot of useful information. I would like to see, I mean, we've done some shows on medical marijuana here, which I think is, you know, it's amazing we spend all our time on this tiny part of the subject, medical marijuana, instead of looking at the big issue and saying, this is all bullshit. I mean, is it working? Is the drug war working? Obviously, it is not working. And, you know, I guess there are serious questions people have. Well, what are you going to do? What are minors going to do? Aren't they going to be more deeply exposed? Isn't it true that alcohol prohibition in the U.S., while it didn't work, it still cut down the deaths from alcohol while it was happening?
It didn't?
That, I believe, is true.
I wouldn't know. I thought because it created a lot of crime. You know,
it cut down deaths from alcohol abuse.
Not from Thompson's submachine
gun.
Not
from the machine guns and, you know, that sort of thing. I was always looking for the other side arguments so that I could, you know, see the whole picture, and I'm still looking for those arguments. So if any of you folks out there have a position that you want to voice about how you think drug legalization or decriminalization or, you know, would be a bad thing, please give us a call at 427-3772. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides you're tuned to. You're listening to Roger Bournik. What do you do these days, Roger? What's your profession?
I cut cheese for a living at a local grocery store.
Oh, so you're kind of a cheesy kind of guy.
Yeah, you know, because I have a French last name, I really like cheese.
And I see. I won't even say where you're employed, lest you be fired as a past heroin user.
They know all about my past. They gave me a job when I really needed one, so.
Well, you know, I live near the what was the 83-year-old cheese factory. It's now the Sunny Cove Cafe. Had a big review in the Good Times.
Oh, yes.
You know, that's a legendary spot for Monterey Jack cheese. But what I wanted to ask you also, Roger, dealing with the fact that, you know, Mother's Day is coming Sunday, and my mother smoked cigarettes from the time she was 13. In her autopsy, it mentioned smoking 7 times. More women die of lung cancer than breast cancer every year. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, stuff like this? I mean, this word prohibition, it didn't do anything. People, when they prohibited alcohol, didn't do anything. FDR, the first day he became president of the United States, he ended prohibition. You know, let's get down to the nitty-gritty because, you know, tobacco obviously is...
We have a call here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let's see if we can put this caller on the air here. Hi, you're on Free Radio with the Big Three. Hello? Hello? Try again, caller. We want your call. Okay, you were saying, Jeffrey, so what's your question?
Well, my question is, you know, it still gets back to that legalizing drugs versus decriminalizing because, again, as Robert pointed out, alcohol is a really tough drug, and nicotine, I think, is the worst of all. I think cocaine and heroin are kind of down.
Can you clarify your distinction you're making between decriminalizing and legalizing?
Well, the lawyers and the judges seem to be arguing on the federal level, the state level, and the local level. Some people feel if you legalize all drugs, then that means, like, right now it's legal to have a can of beer tonight if you're 21 years old. And it's legal tonight to smoke a pack of nicotine cigarettes. So a lot of people feel we should do what was the case prior to 1920. We should legalize heroin.
What you're saying, let me cut to the chase here. Are you saying that legalizing means also allowing, I guess the question is whether you should allow large companies to benefit and sell these drugs for profit and advertise them. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, where it's absolutely legal to buy.
Distinguished from decriminalized, which would mean that you can't sell them in that way, but you can use them without benefit of, you know, without the fear of any penalties.
Right. I mean, legalizing, you know, is okay. the lawyers say is very different from decriminalization.
Okay. And you were asking a question of Roger. Yeah, that's Roger. Sorry, a little confused.
About
go ahead,
this whole thing, you know, I'm not really too smart on these issues of decriminalizing and legalizing and doing this. All I want to say to people out there is that you have the power to kick the pushers out of your life, not only the drug pushers, but, you know, the government pushers, the advertising people. You know, think smaller. You know, buy your shit at flea markets and yard sales. You know, grow your own food. You know, do something just to kick these people out of your life, because it's just dragging you down personally. And one person has the power to do this. You can change your life for the better by stopping, supporting all this crap. You know, not just drugs, but all of it, you know. And it's a revolutionary idea, you know. Support, you know, pirate radio if you can. Do small things in your community that will help. Be compassionate, you know. Heroin use, yeah, it's suffering. It's really a suffering thing. You're in the land of hungry ghosts every day, but you can get out of that and you can move on. And with a little luck and some community support, things could be a bit groovier around here. You know, we could, you know, have places where homeless people can be, help work with them, or, you know, help addicts kick their addictions and move on.
Kick out those recycled politicians who are blocking all this.
Yeah, you know, like decriminalizing this and that is just like more politicians speak to me. It's just like, well, we got to depend on somebody else to do this for us, not just us. We have the power to stop.
Okay, now what do we do, however, with the huge state bureaucracy that is going after people for use of marijuana, for use of heroin, for use of cocaine, all these drugs, which, you know, in circumstances where other people are not injured by this use, which is, I would probably say, 95% of the cases. I mean, if you're driving and you drive, you know, erratically, that's something else. You know, if you're feeding it to a minor, that's something else. But
oh, I heard about that. Some kid had marijuana in their system, you know.
Oh, yeah.
How did that get in there?
Deadly stuff. And those French with their wine-drinking stuff. I don't know about them. But that, we don't call them French. We call them freedoms. They aren't French anymore. That's another listen to this.
Yeah.
But we'll leave that one aside. So, I mean, what about locally? What's the issue? I mean, Marty Wormhout is bringing back on May 20th this latest minuscule reform, and some people don't even regard it as a reform, but as a bad step of ID cards for medical marijuana users at the county level, without considering guidelines, without acting around urging the city to, establish rezone areas so marijuana clubs can open up again instead of just this one wham club, which, by the way, declines to come on free radio, which declines to discuss these issues on the Indie Media website. We have a monopoly situation, like we have with affordable housing and Mercy Housing in the Beach Flats, where all the money goes to one group, and that's got the inside track with the city council. Similarly, with the medical marijuana, you know, it is this one small group, wham, that has, you know, it has the politicians, Emily Riley, Marty Wormhout, they're there, you know, doing the big spiels for these folks, and the rest of the people get to buy their stuff on the levee. You know, they get to buy their stuff outside. They get to risk getting arrested, getting bad medicine, whatever. And not even medicine. Let's take the quantum leap and say, beyond the medicine stuff, you know, how many people use medical marijuana and try to use it marijuana as a way of relaxing after coming home from their two jobs and briefly using their facilities, which they're paying an exorbitant rent for, you know, before trooping off in the morning to do it again, you know?
I don't have a problem with marijuana at all.
How do we deal with the politicians here, and how do we deal with the political climate that says, oh, we have this great progressive city council headed by Emily Riley, this wonderful board of supervisors. Well, Marty is a wonderful supervisor. Let's support her.
Well, what are they selling? They're trying to get into the pot of money somehow. I don't know. It's all a bunch of smoke and mirrors to me.
They don't want to challenge Mark Tracy, the head of the sheriff's department. They don't want to challenge Steve Belcher, the head of the police department. They don't want to challenge the state authorities and the federal grants that come to the police agencies.
The federal grants.
Through doing this. You know, and
pot of money.
You know, I mean, SCAN is now supposedly doing a focus on the budget. SCAN is the Santa Cruz Action Network, the organization that elected quite a number of the so-called self-proclaimed progressive politicians over the last two decades. And there's, I guess, budget hearings every Tuesday, every other Tuesday. I think there was one Somebody told me, in fact, I think it was the caller who called in the first part of the hour, that he had been to the Riley budget hearings. Are they Wednesdays? Yeah, they're Wednesdays. And you can go to the budget hearings and check them out. Either they're Wednesdays or Tuesdays. Call the city council at 420-5020 to find out, by the way. Or go online. Just go online to the Santa Cruz City website. Look up City of Santa Cruz and go to the website. You can get information on that. But, you know, SCAN is looking at it's the one thing it's done. It's abandoned its commitment to homeless people. It's abandoned its commitment to oversight of the police department. It's abandoned its commitment to rent control or to some kind of affordable housing for Latino people or protection for those who are being evicted into so-called better housing for fewer people.
Exactly.
They've abandoned all that, and what they've got now are the same clowns on the steering committee, Bernice Belton, Nora Hockman, Sandy Brown, the same people who've been doing the same thing year after year. And, you know, in many ways, I've said before, I don't say everything these folks do is wrong or bad, but I'm saying you get the same institutionalized politicians who are not pushing for the positions that even the general membership voted for around issues like, you know, ending the police state in Santa Cruz and the drug war. I mean, there's an obvious thing. You know, I mean,
that'd be great.
I mean, if you have people from outside coming in and saying, okay, you will arrest these people for, well, that's one thing. But if you have this internally generated hysteria, this internally generated paranoia, this internally generated prohibition mentality, that is something we have to fight and stop. And I don't mean feel-good columns from Christopher Crone in The Good Times, which we get to see, you know, every week. Thank you very much. The former mayor who gives medical marijuana to 13 people but can't find it in his brain to come out with a program so the rest of the people can get medical marijuana, to say nothing of marijuana generally. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert.
Hey there, Scott Graham.
How you doing?
Good. We know who you are.
Uh-oh.
What you got?
Hopefully you're not coming to get me.
Yeah, I hope you're go ahead.
Anyway, I was just calling about this whole drug war thing.
Uh-huh.
I think the drug war actually has been very successful. They've set out to have this drug war to create a big pot of money for people. And it's been very successful. It's employed lots of prison guards. It's employed lots of lawyers. It's increased the number of judges and police officers nationwide, so it's been very successful.
Well, that's
and it
true.
Will continue to be successful as long as drugs are illegal.
Well, and so in other words, in a way, this is a way of assisting all those folks who want to go into the prison guard, police, drug testing business, and so perhaps we should actually be supporting the drug war.
Well, that's it. I mean, the whole system right now, it's like I have a friend that's currently in the Santa Cruz County Jail, in the women's unit, and 90% of the women in there are in there on drug charges. No violence, you know, no robbery, nothing like that, drug charges. So if all of a sudden drugs were illegal, they'd only have 1/10 of the female prisoners that they now have. And I'm sure the male population is pretty much similar. There might be, you know, might be a difference of 5% or something. But, you know, it's like the criminal justice system, this is the oil that keeps that machine moving, is the drug war. Without it, judges would be out of work, lawyers would be out of work, police would be out of work, guards would be out of work.
So we know this, caller. What do we do at a local level to fight back?
On a local level, I think the thing to do would be, try to lobby the politicians to say, listen, you know, this isn't working. One of the things is Proposition 36 that was passed a couple of years ago by the voters of California to, instead of sending drug abusers to jail or prison, they would get treatment.
Has that been working?
The way it's been implemented in most counties, it isn't working.
And why is that, and how is it being implemented?
Well, like here in Santa Cruz County, a lot of people are not getting programs. And even if they are getting programs, the programs aren't being paid for. They have to pay for the programs themselves in order to get the program.
This sounds like the problem that you had, Roger, back in 1985. You wanted to get in a program, but there was a huge waiting list, right?
No, a long waiting list to get on maintenance here at that time.
And so it's like, you know, that was the whole idea of Prop 36 was that instead of spending the money on incarceration, the money would be spent on a program. Well, here in Santa Cruz, if you're lucky, if you get sentenced to Prop 36, if you're lucky, they'll pay for the first month of your program. But say you get sentenced to a 12-month program, then you have to pay for the other 11 months. If after that first month you haven't been able to get a job, because a lot of businesses won't hire you if you have a felony on your record, mm-hmm. and you've only got 1 month clean, and that happens to be the month that you've been in jail. So after 1 month, you're just thrown back out. I mean, it's almost like they're wanting to continue this whole drug war thing.
Well, it sounds like they want to dump Proposition 36 and build bigger, better prisons.
Right.
It's the biggest growth industry in this country is privately owned prisons.
But 36 was voted by the in as an initiative by the voters, and aren't judges required to give people drug counseling rather than prison on the first offense?
Well, the judge sentences people to Proposition 36, and then there's the program people that work for the county that actually implement it are like saying, okay, you get what, you know, we'll pay for the first month of your treatment, but that's it. You got to pay for the rest of it. Or some of the judges are actually sentencing people to drug court, which is not a program. It's not a drug rehabilitation program.
What is drug court?
Well, drug court is a very strict form of probation where once a week you have to show up in court, you get drug tested two or three times a week, you have to attend classes, you have to go to Narcotics Anonymous meetings, you know, seven times a week and all this kind of stuff.
You get a Bible provided?
And you have to pay for all this stuff. And
what if you're indigent?
You still have to pay. If you can't pay, you can't play.
So, in other words, they're violating Proposition 36 for indigent people, is what you're saying.
They're violating Proposition 36 for anybody. They're sentencing, giving them drug court as Proposition 36.
Have there been any court challenges
and
for this?
No, so far there hasn't. And another thing they're doing, too, for heroin addicts is they're giving them the methadone program as Prop 36. Now, that's not a drug rehabilitation program. That's more of a diversion program. Okay, we're going to keep, you know, we're going to switch your addiction from heroin to methadone. Now you're going to be addicted to this stuff, which is even harder to kick than heroin.
True.
And so it's like they're playing this big shell game with people on Prop 36 here in this county. So locally, that's one of the things that people could do would be to start talking to, you know, the Board of Supervisors and the sheriff and the person that runs the county health department, because they basically run Prop 36, and say, listen, let's implement this in the spirit in which it was voted on, which is rehabilitation, taking the money away from the jail, taking the money away from the prisons, and actually giving people treatment, not giving them 1 month of treatment and saying, okay, now you're on your own, because they know people are going to fail. If there's no support for them, most people aren't ready after a month of being clean to get their life together.
It takes several times.
And, you know, it takes several months. You know, and so if somebody's paying their rent or their cost of the rehab program, they're more likely to stay there.
Hey,
if after 30 days they can't stay there anymore,
right,
of course they're going to end up back out on the streets and using again.
Hey,
which means
you.
They go back to jail. The judges have some work. So the lawyers have some work. The cops
right.
have some work. You know, it's just like...
Jeffrey has a quick comment here.
Yes. In Marin County, the wealthiest county per capita in the United States, it's so insidious, caller, that, believe it or not, they floated a bond issue to build the new Marin County Jail inside of the Frank Lloyd Wright Civic Center, even though he said long before he died that there should never be a jail inside of the only government building he ever was the architect. So they haven't paid off the bond issue yet. So what judges are doing in Marin County is they don't want any empty beds ever in the Marin County jail. So therefore, the first time that you're busted for drunk driving in Marin, for instance, or for selling marijuana, whatever, right away the judge makes sure that you are put in jail to pay off the bond issue. Now, Marin did reopen their honor farm so that, you know, people who are heavily, you know, into drugs can get rehabilitated. But I just wanted the caller to know how insidious things are in Marin County, California, where I happen to be going tomorrow.
And we'll get a full report perhaps later. Caller, thank you for calling, and call again.
Sure.
All righty.
One thing I did want to say about the methadone program when I was on it in the 5 years. When I started, I was paying $150 a month for methadone maintenance. At the end of that 5 years, it had gone up to $365 a month. Seems like, you know, every couple of months they were raising it, kept on raising it, just like any drug pusher would. And it generated, in a way that was good, it generated anger in me that I resolved to get off methadone for good.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, we have been talking with Roger Bornik and, of course, the infamous Jeffrey Gale. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathroom Spears Broadsides. We have about half an hour left, and I'm going to try to run you through some updates as well as a few interviews from the street. We may be getting a call from David Brown of Manteca, California, who is fighting anti-homeless laws up there. Manteca is a city of 50,000, about Santa Cruz size, near Stockton, and they passed a law criminalizing homelessness. Oh, I'm sorry, criminalizing sleeping at night, criminalizing stashing your stuff somewhere, criminalizing behaviors associated with the homelessness. And naturally, they would want to criminalize homelessness. I mean, that would be wrong.
Is this part of the conservative compassionate program or something?
No, it's part of the liberal bullshit program. Probably got it from Santa Cruz and San Francisco. Ironically, although, you know, conservative authoritarians have a similar program, you know, there are some conservatives like Wiley Drake in Buena Park, California, who's the pastor of the First Baptist Church and a big homophobe and a big supporter of Bush's and a big supporter of the war, who nonetheless has done more for the homeless than the Santa Cruz City Council will ever do in terms of lodging 200 people in his church every night. You know, I mean, he, and doing so at risk of jail. They've convicted him of three misdemeanors down there. So, you know, it's not the conservatives I'm worried about in Santa Cruz. The liberals are the ones in power. They're the ones who criminalized such basic functions as sleeping, as sitting down near a building, as holding up a sign saying, please need help, spare change. And I've seen, and this isn't something that, you know, I kind of harp on this. I go back to it, not just because it exists, but because I constantly see new evidence of harassment under it. I took a walk, what was it, last night or the night before, and I walked down past Denny's, and there were police officers harassing a guy for holding up a sign which said, you know, I don't know, you know, want money for this or that. And it's annoying. It may be regarded in a way as degrading and humiliating to be seeing this in public places, but it's also a sign of the times, and unfortunately it's the reality that we are in the middle of. And provided you're not engaging in actually assaulting someone or, you know, doing something that is, you know, fist on nose, it's First Amendment protected. And you might say, not anymore, it isn't, because the courts don't do that. Well, yes, it is. The Constitution is the Constitution, regardless of the kinds of contortions that, for example, if the slave owners want to give us the Plessy versus Ferguson decisions of 1896 that say separate but equal is okay and Jim Crow laws are fine, the 14th Amendment and the 13th Amendment and the 15th Amendment are still in force. I'm sorry, that's the reality of it, and we have the right to act as though that were the case.
And Robert, I'm sure you saw in the Santa Cruz Sentinel this week an incredible letter by Mark Trammell with a headline on it, The Working Homeless. He said, I can't believe what the Santa Cruz Sentinel printed in today's edition on April 22nd. Quote, local experts agree this makes for a renter's market. Quote, unquote, how can anyone justify having to pay $1,160 for a one-bedroom apartment in Santa Cruz, California? It should have read, quote, local experts agree this makes for a rich man's renter's market, period, unquote. Landlords, mortgage companies, and all state government officials are robbing the poor people of California blind, not to mention employers pay below poverty wages and have eliminated the old cost of living increase. Rent goes up, food goes up, everything goes up except wages. How many readers can say they only spend one-third of their net monthly income for living expenses? That's the formula California was built on. Now, putting a roof over one's head costs one-half of the income paycheck, which does not include utilities, food, gas, car payment, and the rest of life's essentials. Wake up, California and America, before a repeat of the 1929 Wall Street crash happens again. Sure, we're having hard times now, but this is nothing compared to where we're headed if this inflation and so-called, quote, fair market value, unquote, continues and employers pay poverty-scale wages. This kind of free enterprise drives the average working man into homelessness. Believe me, I know, we are the working homeless.
That's signed by
Mark Trammell, Santa Cruz, California.
Okay, we have a caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Walt.
Hey, Walt.
Hey, I just wanted to, let me turn my radio down.
Sure.
Hi, I just wanted to comment a little bit about what your guest was just saying. He said that people need to wake up. Well, in a lot of ways, when people take drugs, they're trying to go to sleep. And I think they're trying to, like, block out how bad things are.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, that was just an observation I thought I'd put forth.
Sure, sure. Anything else?
I like your show.
Hey, always glad to hear that. Hey, thank you for calling.
Yeah, take care.
All righty. Bye-bye. And 427-3772 is the call-in line. You have about 25 minutes if you want to call in, and that's still open to you. You can talk to me. Right